Welcome to Interviews for Resistance. Since election night 2016, the streets of the U.S. have rung with resistance. People all over the country have woken up with the conviction that they must do something to fight inequality in all its forms. But many are wondering what it is they can do. In this series, we'll be talking with experienced organizers, troublemakers, and thinkers who have been doing the hard work of fighting for a long time. They'll be sharing their insights on what works, what doesn't, what has changed, and what is still the same. I am Sarah Jaffe, your host.
My name is Michael Kink. I'm the executive director of the Strong Economy for All Coalition. It's a labor community coalition based in New York working on economic justice, income inequality, and racial justice issues related to those. I've been a legal aid lawyer. I've worked for AIDS activists, LGBT, civil rights groups. I worked in government for a little while, and I have, through my whole career, worked on law, policy, direct action, civil disobedience, communications, all kinds of crazy stuff that is good for resistance.
And once had a meditating outside of Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, where to start? Let's go back a little bit to, because we were talking about how after the election, the networks started moving very quickly from even networks from several years back.
I think the day after the election, I, like many people, wrote, a couple dozen groups and individuals that I would want to see connected working together after this stuff. And by that afternoon, I was on like a 168-person email chain that included a lot of my friends and colleagues from back in the AIDS activism and healthcare activism, gay rights days. I think there was an instantaneous mobilization. And, I was scheduled to give a talk in the city that night and got off the train and walked into tens of thousands of people flooding the streets against Trump. So I think there are new people, young people, veterans, activists, folks that have fought for the last several decades, fought against, Bill Clinton doing bad stuff and Reagan doing bad stuff and George W. Bush and his dad doing bad stuff. And there are some skills, I think, that are left over that are totally relevant now. And then there's a moment where, we really haven't seen anything at the mass level since the civil rights movement and anti-war movements. I think the AIDS movement was the most recent large-scale thing. Certainly Occupy, certainly Black Lives Matter, certainly the more recent movements have given people an opportunity to work those muscles and carry out those fights. But during the AIDS movement, it was millions of people, life and death decisions. During the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement in the 50s and 60s, you were like literally changing the history of the country. Folks have been trying to do that again. We're going to need to do things at that scale and bigger in order to meet the moment that we have right now.
The thing that I kept going back to in the weeks and months since the election was the life and death part, right? Was that, like, in this moment now, these are going to be, I mean, they were in many cases already, but, like, the life and death decision part feels a lot more real now.
It's more widespread. I mean, I think that's part of the wisdom of people of color saying to white folks, hey, we saw this coming. Yeah. It's been life and death for us for a long time. There's no question about that. And if you're talking about, having your life threatened by the police, that is an everyday thing. If you're talking about the HIV epidemic, when you had millions and millions of people, gay people, drug users, people of color, sex partners of anybody under the sun, kids that were getting transfusions for blood disease, right?
Yeah.
It was an incredible intersectional movement of people that often were at odds with one another, right? I mean, we worked in the South with, gay men that had never been to a black church and black women that had never been to a gay bar, right?
Yeah.
But they found common cause. They stood on the line together. When, we fought for health care for people with disabilities at the Capitol in Albany, we had people with AIDS chained to people in wheelchairs, chained to people with psychiatric disabilities. Connections and courage that people can show when they stand together is exactly what the moment needs.
Yeah.
And so, there are folks that know how to carry out mass civil disobedience. There are folks that know how to mobilize quickly. I saw a bird dogging train. I saw someone send an email to one of these lists saying we need to do bird dogging on the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah.
In 2 days, there were 73 bird dogging actions with people bottom lining every single one of them and talking points and prioritization all across the country, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Things happen very quickly with the connection of digital media and email.
Yeah.
And, you know, those folks are a mix of people that were around back in the day and people that are just coming to the fore now and all those folks working together. And so we are not without resources for resistance. There are a lot of resources for resistance. There are folks that have fought these battles, that have knit, you know, black and brown and Latino, Asian people together, Native people together over time. I do think the AIDS movement is particularly important in that, you know, at least in my experience of it, it was cross-cultural, cross-racial. There was a lot of fight back around white privilege and sort of people working out how to work together effectively.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, in my experience, I mean, I have different types of work, but it was authentically national. It was about places where there were progressive and blue states and liberals and folks who were on our side.
Yeah.
It was also in places where folks hated gay people or hated drug users or hated people of color. The people in power were trying to kill those folks.
Yeah.
And folks found resources to fight back. Folks mobilized public opinion. Folks worked with faith leaders. Folks worked with cultural leaders, musicians, movie stars, right?
Yeah.
There were things that we did to turn the culture that came because populations under the gun mobilized and worked together.
Yeah, and the two things, right, that, I mean, there's a whole lot that's going to be up for grabs and moving in the Trump era, but the two things that have that similar sort of life and death balance are, on the one hand, healthcare and the potential of repealing, you know, the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid and Medicare, which, again, now looks less likely than it did just a month ago, but still is certainly on the table. These people would like to do that.
Oh, yeah.
And the other hand, deportations.
Yep.
And the fact that Obama already deported over 3 million people and Trump wants to make that look like nothing. And so, up to you which one you want to start with.
Well, you know, I think the issue of deportations is powerful and clearly, you know, it's an existential threat if you're, you know, a kid that's facing a parent being taken from them, if you're a parent that's facing a kid being taken care of out of them, if you're in a community that values every single member and folks are hiding and running the gun. It has...
Or even if you don't value your members, but 50% of your community is potentially deportable, and then your local economy collapses.
You know, there are all kinds of things about it that are, you know, the idea that it will be easy to arrest and deport tens of millions of residents of the United States of America is crazy.
Yeah.
And if you go back throughout American history to the, you know, to the extent that, you know, United States of America is a governmental entity, I'm afraid I'm going to have to put in the parking lot all the wars with Native peoples and Indigenous peoples, Indians, stuff like that. If you take the settler colonialists, right, that were fighting the British colonials, you know, massive disobedience of government, gumming up the works of government, standing in the way of government, slowing down government, not cooperating with government, withdrawing consent from government, you know, ungovernable, right? You know, I mean, there are literally volumes of methods to build power against a government that's tyrannical or abusing its authority or otherwise screwing with regular people that live in the society it purports to govern.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think that the folks that live here and have made their lives here need to find a way to live decent lives in the United States of America. I think our laws should reflect our people, and I think our people, you know, I have, you know, German and Italian illegal immigrant forebears that were demonized during their time for being anarchists or, you know, being bomb throwers, being all the things that folks call Muslims and Latinos now. The prospects for alliances between folks that respect and want to work with and protect immigrant communities and immigrant communities themselves are really powerful. And that is a place to show courage where, you know, like during the Civil Rights era when you had Freedom Riders, when you had white folks coming from the North to stand with black folks in the South, to build a common currency, to demonstrate common courage, to eat with each other, to worship with each other, to like dance and hang out and have fun with each other, and then to fight for one another, exactly what's needed now. And I don't think that, you know, Trump and ICE will be able to deport tens of millions of Americans without a fight. And I think that the kinds of mass trainings in civil disobedience and direct action that we saw during the Civil Rights era, during the anti-Vietnam War era, we're going to see again in America. It's already happening. There are already those connections being made, the communities coming together. And I think, you know, when they try to really carry it out on the basis that they're talking about, cable TV news viewers are going to see hundreds or thousands of grandmas and high school kids and church ladies and church men standing together on a block with immigrant families. And it's going to be Star Wars stormtroopers like coming to snatch screaming kids from their parents. I don't think America wants to look like that, but we need to have the courage to show what it really is, right? Yeah. If they can do it in secret, if they can do it with, you know, all this rhetoric about criminality, you know, I mean, it's teaching people that aren't victimized by broken windows policing what the consequences of broken windows policing are, right? It's like the death penalty for a broken taillight if you came here from Guatemala. It's insane, right? If you're going back, if they're trying to send you to society that you came fleeing for your life from, it is totally insane. So I think on immigration, thank God for the ACLU to slow things down in the courts. That's another thing I'll say from back in the AIDS movement. You know, the AIDS movement was multidisciplinary. Mm-hmm. I was a lawyer in the AIDS movement that filed lawsuits and got injunctions against Giuliani while the next day we were flooding the streets and protesting and trying to get government right. You have to do every angle. And I think the immigrant activism will be similar. You're going to see efforts in the courts to stop things that are clearly unconstitutional. You're going to see grassroots organizing of people to stand together and understand their rights and to build rights for those that have no rights through political action. And then we're going to need, you know, civil disobedience. We're going to need, you know, the Gandhian satyagraha where we express love and care for one another through standing with one another and stopping bad things from happening to people we care about. And, you know, there were people that did that for my great aunt who came over here in an iron ore freighter from Germany, way, you know, kids sneak up, you know, from Guatemala. She came here when she was 14, you know. I mean, that kind of thing has happened throughout American history, and folks have fought for immigrants, and that's going to happen now. On healthcare, you know, I think there are a couple of different angles. One, you know, even folks that, you know, hated Obamacare because of their racist anger at the president are beginning to understand the value of the benefits that the Affordable Care Act provided to them and their families. There are, like during the AIDS movement, there are like recovering opioid drug addicts in Indiana that are in the same position as, people that are living outside of nursing homes with independent living plans in Kentucky and West Virginia, coal miners in West Virginia that get their black lung covered under the Affordable Care Act, along with all the, working millennial folks on the coasts and in Portland and stuff like that, right? And you've got a lot of people that are unified by self-interest that you need healthcare to survive in society.
Yeah.
And I do think they have the political power to get rid of it if they want to. They're beginning to understand the political consequences of just trashing the system.
Yeah.
I thought at the beginning that they were going to go for a shock doctrine type vibe, blow it all up, repeal it, create chaos, and then rebuild something that shoves a lot of money at insurance companies in the wreckage.
Yeah.
That's still a very real possibility.
Yeah.
I think the Trump budget will probably include Medicaid block grants. That's what Kellyanne Conway told the American public when she was on the Sunday Today a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
Medicaid block grants means, at least in prior legislation, cuts of 20-25% to Medicaid funding and health care for Americans, elimination of the legal right to care, so that... a lot of lawsuits had to be brought over it, but right now, if you have HIV in the state that has Medicaid, you're entitled to antiretroviral drugs that can keep you alive. If you don't have an entitlement, the state is allowed to say, well, we can only afford to give 50 people in this county HIV drugs this month. You're the 51st, so you're not going to get them.
Yeah.
We can only afford 25 grandmas in nursing homes this month. And your grandma's at 26, so figure out what you're going to do with her, That is a very real prospect. And, like, for a state like New York, where I work, getting rid of the Affordable Care Act could lose us $5 billion. Getting rid of the Medicaid entitlement and the current federal matching rate and slashing cuts could, easily cut another... $8-10 billion out of healthcare. You're looking at double-digit billion-dollar cuts in the healthcare system, and then it's up to someone like Governor Andrew Cuomo or whoever succeeds him, or Jerry Brown or whoever succeeds him, to recreate a decent healthcare system for people in their state. And so I think, people with AIDS, people with disabilities, healthcare activists are going to work like crazy all over the country to slow or stop.
Yeah.
The efforts to get rid of the federal health care system. But I do think that if the Republicans use the power they have to do what they say they're going to do, then we're going to be back to fights at state capitals to recreate a decent health care system state by state.
Yeah.
And it will be up to states like New York, California, Minnesota, state of Washington, places that have functioning Democratic majorities or voting majorities, to actually show the rest of the country what it looks like. And, we were talking about, one way to do it when you're losing a lot of money is to tax rich people and get some more money in the system.
Yeah.
Another way to do it when you tax the rich people to a certain extent is to cut the HMOs and the insurance companies out of the equation.
Yeah.
And states have
experience.
I assume you're going to have to do both because politicians are going to keep compromising until the political revolution is complete. But, single-payer health care is something that becomes way more in the realm of possibility to everyday elected officials if all of a sudden you have to do more with less.
Yeah.
And you can't give the insurance companies the 15-20% of the cut that they normally take in order to, run claims and make massive profits for their shareholders and pay their CEOs over the moon salaries.
And so in New York, to stay on this tack, there has been a bill introduced in, every year since, 1991 or something like that, Les Dick Gottfried.
Yep.
And so I guess, getting to New York politics is in the weeds for everybody who doesn't live in New York, but of course we have our little problem in the state Senate. But that the little problem, of course, I'm talking about the IDC, is also getting more attention in the post-Trump era. I feel like the protest that, what do you call it, Peralta?
Yep.
That's the name?
Yep.
Right. Have been much bigger than anything we saw since the beginning of the IDC.
Yeah. You know, I think it's a moment when people are demanding strong, concrete, real things from anyone who purports to be a representative of them, right? And that includes, you know, progressives that are protesting Schumer, folks in Jackson Heights that are protesting Peralta. Even Trump voters said it's time for government to start sticking up for me, and I want some stuff from them.
Yeah.
And it's kind of weird in that it's also, you know, this kind of anti-fascist moment like the 30s in America or in Germany, where even bad politicians will do important good things once in a while. Right? And so there's these cross currents, right?
Yeah.
The IDC has, at some level, allowed Republicans to maintain control of the state Senate by aligning with them.
Yeah.
Democrats, mainline Democrats, all kinds of Democrats have failed to provide good candidates with strong, compelling messages and win enough elections to be clearly in charge. Republicans have used dog whistle racism on Long Island and across upstate to maintain power, to gerrymander their way into a, you know, their all-white Republican conference that drains political power away from communities of color in New York City.
Yeah.
And the IDC has a big foot in that camp. At the same time, the IDC has some smart politicians that are actually putting out strong proposals. I mean, the IDC came out with, here's what we need to protect collective bargaining rights in New York and have labor unions.
Yeah.
Jeff Klein sponsored the carried interest bill that I'm working on to tax hedge fund billionaires. So, you know, I think any community that is mobilizing to hold their politicians' feet to the fire should be doing more of it and is on exactly the right track. I don't think you can expect, you know, folks that are doing some bad things to do all bad things, right? Governor Cuomo is a very problematic figure in New York politics, right?
Yes.
He often compromises. He often runs this Clintonian triangulation game.
Yeah.
He is not as clear and direct and straightforward as many people that work on the issues that I work on would like him to be. But at the same time, if we create a political environment where there is clear, strong public support for the issues that we're fighting for, he, like any other politician, is going to scurry over in that direction and try to get in front of the parade to lead it.
Yeah.
So that he did help pass the $15 minimum wage in New York.
Yeah.
Not as strongly and as statewide as many of us would have liked to see.
Yeah.
But he did it, and he did it in a very clear and direct way. He spoke up very clearly about reproductive rights and the need to codify Roe v. Wade.
Yeah.
Now, his deals with the Republicans makes it impossible to codify Roe v. Wade, which is, you know, exactly what we're talking about here. You've got folks that will do good things at some point, bad things, and those of us that are in the middle of it need to talk to the vast majority of folks who aren't paying attention to every little detail.
Yeah.
I think there are certainly ways in which Cuomo's education policies are close to Betsy DeVos's policies. But his education policies have also changed over time because folks have been hammering him, right? If you just say, Cuomo is Trump, people are going to be like, what?
Yeah.
I just heard Cuomo saying we got to protect immigrants.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I think what it requires you to do is to fight for what you need. And call the politicians out.
Yeah.
Say, if any politician of any stripe is not providing our community what we need, we're going to go protest them and take them down.
Yeah.
And, you know, go back to the AIDS movement. You know, a lot of times when we were trying to save things we had, we needed those damn Republicans to stand up and do things.
Yeah.
We needed smart staffers that work for Lamar Alexander or, you know, George Pataki or Joe Bruno to understand what it meant to their communities, right? That if you do HIV prevention and provide HIV drugs and get people's viral load down,
or
you're
Mike
not going to have mass... Well, Mike Pence. I mean, you know, And that's the whole thing, if you take it in a historical perspective. It's so frustrating to be rolling the rock up and then it falls down, and you got to roll it back up and have it fall down, right? There were literally battles that we fought before. I wrote a Medicaid block grants op-ed in, 45 minutes because I wrote 10 Medicaid block grants op-eds back in the 90s. The muscle memory came back, right? I had to look up the references. We have the internet now.
Yeah.
So I could find, some relevant statistics.
Yeah.
But there are battles that we fought and won before.
Yeah.
We have not previously seen unified Republican control in Washington of the magnitude we have now.
Yeah.
And we haven't seen the kind of vicious political force of straight up fascism in play before.
Yeah.
Right? There has always been racism, there have always been dog whistles, but this element of violent retribution, the unbelievable willingness to go beyond dog whistles to air sirens, that's a real X factor, and that is a really scary moment in our history, and that is, I think we're called to the moment to be strong against it. It's just incredible.
Yeah, and so you said something there that I think is really interesting when you're talking about Trump voters that also expect him to actually do things. And I think this is a point that gets missed a lot, is there's this tendency from people who vote Democrat to assume that obviously we voted for Hillary Clinton even though we know she voted for the Iraq War and we don't like it and we know this and that and we know she was on the board of Walmart and we don't like this. But, we voted for her because she obviously was better than Trump. But they don't picture people who voted for Trump also making that calculation. They sort of totalize everybody who voted for Trump as people who 100% support everything that Trump does,
right,
which is also not the case.
Right.
And so, but I think we're in an interesting moment, right, where people not trusting the government means they also don't trust, even people who voted for Donald Trump don't entirely trust him and are, I met the one guy that was at the Government Sachs camp out already, right? There's already people who are nope, that was a bad idea.
Bunch of the momentum strikers, right? We, the hedge clippers, worked with the momentum strikers here in upstate New York. You know, we did a paper on how the hedge fund billionaire Leon Black and the private equity billionaire Steven Schwarzman bought the company, screwed the workers, got insanely rich in the process.
And now Schwarzman is on Trump's economic
Schwarzman
team.
Schwarzman is Trump's guy. So the Trump voters are like, wait a minute, Trump put this guy in charge of the economy?
Literally getting on his private plane with him to fly to Florida after...
I do think that there were explicit promises that Trump made that Trump voters believed. He was going to drain the swamp, right? He's filled the swamp. The swamp is full of swamp monsters, right? Goldman Sachs, all these hedge fund guys, Schwarzman. Trump said he was going to bring back millions of industrial working jobs to middle America. And it was his billionaire buddies. It was Carl Icahn and Steven Schwarzman that looted those companies, outsourced those jobs, drove down those wages, robbed those pensions, right? We have reconfigured hedge clippers, for the Trump era to be kind of like whistleblowers for working people, to keep an eye on the Trump billionaire class, to keep an eye on the kleptocracy, to expose the swamp, and to say to those people that voted twice for Obama and then for Trump, or those people that were for Bernie in the primary and Trump in the general, here's what he's doing. Here's how he's not draining the swamp. Here's how he's screwing you guys. Here's how his trade deals are going to work out. And, I really don't think that you're going to be able to sprinkle a little racism and international violence and war across it and pull the wool over people's eyes.
Yeah.
I think in 2 years for the midterms, when Republicans have been collaborating with insane, kleptocratic, clown-driven administration, they're going to get thrown out of office. And in 4 years... the Democrats will have no choice based on the way people will demand candidates and vote their own interests, but to put up a candidate that will actually find a way to deliver on these fake promises that Trump is not going to deliver on, and will actually bring some of the Bernie political revolution forward into the country.
It's basically that or die.
There's no other way, you know, forward for the Democrats as a party. And, you know, it has been frustrating to me, just like as a person that wants representatives to vote for me too, as well as someone that like works with candidates and works with government officials, you know. I see someone like Elizabeth Warren, I see someone like Zephyr Teachout, I see someone like Shama Swan, I see, you know, candidates that can speak out forcefully and directly and link, you know, economic interests and racial interests and class interests and get people to stand together.
Yeah.
You know, Harold Washington, he was mayor of Chicago, Chewy when he ran last time around. You know, there are people that are going to be able to do this and do this effectively, and the moment is right for them. And I hope that we have hundreds and hundreds of people like, you know, Zephyr or Bernie or Elizabeth Warren at their local level, they're going to say, I'm just going to go do this, because it is clearer than ever that, you know, conventional politics have failed. It's clearer than ever that, you know, the systems of money and politics that are all linked to Wall Street and banks and insurance companies and special interests looking out for themselves instead of regular people, it's clear what's going on. And, you know, I grew up in Illinois, you know, the Abe Lincoln, you can fool, you know, all the people some of the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time, right? I think this crazy situation we're in has made more people's eyes more wide open than they've ever been before.
Yeah.
And to the extent that folks like you and me may perceive some Trump voters as insufficiently attentive to reality, reality has a way of getting in touch with you if you're not in touch with it, you know?
Yeah, the Democrats learned that this election. And
when you're
Trump's
talking about money,
too.
When you're talking about household budgets, when you're talking about retirement funds, when you're talking about health care, you know, there are some basic things people need. And if the government isn't delivering it, they will say it's time for change.
Yeah.
And our job is to make sure that we can, like, make that change be as effective and help as many people as possible.
Since we were talking about hedge clippers and we were talking about resistance and actions that are being planned, people are planning things around tax day. And one of the other things, other than general strikes, that's floating around in the air is the idea of tax resistance. So,
yeah, you know, I think this year for tax day, it's like, Donald Trump, release your damn taxes and don't give huge tax cuts to your billionaire buddies, right? If we're going to have marches in cities and towns and counties all over America and folks are going to strike out at Trump, it's crazy that he hasn't released his taxes, so we can't see where he gets his money and whether he pays any taxes.
And if he has any money.
If he has any money, if the Russians are the ones that give him money. I mean, it's, all this kind of stuff should be public. And the plan for massive tax cuts for billionaires who, you know, already have so much money that they're hurting our economy by having so much money and not letting the rest of us have any of it, you know? I mean, that is crazy. We need to mobilize. But I think if we continue, you know, if Stephen Miller and Stephen Bannon and Trump continue to run the country and we have international wars and we have, like, you know, a government that won't comply with court orders, we're going to need tax resistance. And, you know, like you said, tax resistance is the kind of thing like general strikes that people toss around really easily and say, oh, we should just not pay our taxes. But I do think, again, this moment is pretty unique in American history, right? Tax resistance has been a part of the history of the United States of America since the beginning, right?
I seem to have heard
party,
about that.
Right? Massive non-cooperation with the colonial English government. I'm setting aside the atrocities against Native peoples, indigenous peoples. There's a whole other resistance thing we could talk about there.
Yeah.
In the abolitionist movement against slavery, in the suffrage movement for women's votes, in every anti-war movement that we've had throughout our history.
Yeah.
During the civil rights movement, you know, non-cooperation with government and non-cooperation with taxation has been an American patriotic tradition. Like, when you have a tyrannical government that's not doing what regular people need it to do, you can withdraw your cooperation. And I think that with, you know, financial tech, with apps, with the ability of, like, you know, anyone who wants to create a bank can create a bank, you know. And I think, like a general strike, it's not going to be something that's going to happen. It needs to happen if everybody's going to do it. There's people that need to get together and create a means by which folks can actually feel comfortable not paying their taxes by putting it into a separate account and getting receipts for it and all doing it together as a collective political statement, right? It doesn't mean you go spend your tax money on a fancy dinner or on, you know, tuition for your kid at community college. It doesn't work like that.
Yeah.
But if, you know, with smart, patriotic people in the financial services industry and technology, we're able to give people some reliable way to move their money somewhere else.
Yeah, I heard there's a Union Bank.
Amalgamated in the city, you know, North Dakota, you can charter a state bank. Any state could create a state law that allows itself to charter a government bank. Jerry Brown could do it in California. Andrew Cuomo could do it in New York. If we get to that level of tyranny, I think there will be political support for that. And I don't think it will be, you know, again, history of America, for better or worse, is things that people thought were illegal or transgressive or somehow disruptive became recognized as patriotic after the fact. I think we're in a moment where the Trump administration will be seen as a dark, dark time during our nation's history, will be seen as a tremendous mistake by voters. Voters like the Momentum Strikers and that guy from Utah from the mobile home park, and people are already beginning to realize some of the problems. Trump has the lowest public opinion rating of any president at this point in American history. You know, if he's still in office and he is actually violating the Constitution by not complying with court orders, it will be people's patriotic duty to stand against the government, and we'll be able to do it together. It won't be hard to do that. So, you know, general strike, I'm all for, like, let's organize that and fight that. That's a battleground thing.
Yeah.
Tax resistance is something where that is a place where we can break their backs, and when and if it's time, we should do it together. And it will be something that, you know, even your conservative Republican uncle in the suburbs somewhere will say, I can't take this. And that's when we'll be able to structure the time.
Interviews for Resistance is a project of Sarah Jaffe with assistance from Laura Faillebois and support from the Nation Institute. You can find more information at necessarytrouble.org. Thanks for listening.